This is Frank Hymans recording an oral history interview with Eileen and Bill Pearson. The place is 5 Windmill Street, Millers Point. Today is the 28th of June, 2005, and we're doing this project for the Department of Housing's Millers Point Oral History Project. This will be tape number DOC-MPFH-1, side A. Eileen, we'll start with you first. Eileen, could you tell me your maiden name, please?
Eileen Kemp.
Right. And when were you born, Eileen?
28th of August, 1913.
Okay. And that's in Sydney, was it?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, can you tell me some of the background of the Kemp family? Where do they come from?
The Kemps came from Tyshurst in Sussex, England, and the first Kemp in Australia, or my mother's family, was Isaac Kemp, who was a convict. He was transported for life for sterling goods worth 24 shillings and sixpence. And he was sort of working as a convict. He was hired out to work for different landowners around the district, and he became, when he got his ticket of leave, he became a drover, ox team, droving, and he had a child with an Aboriginal woman who was only known as Mary. Nobody knew her, and she apparently just disappeared after she had the child. He brought the child up, and the child's name was William, and he married William Kemp. He married a woman that had come out as a free settler called Emma Elliott, and they had a daughter, Frances, who was my mother's father's mother.
All right, okay.
So they lived around Canamble. Frances was 18 when her husband, her father William, was working as a blacksmith on this property, and Frances became pregnant to the landowner, a guy called Samuel Elliott, who was also a convict, made good, bought land, and Frances married a guy called Atwood Gardner, and throughout his life, my grandfather Edgar always thought that his grandparents were his parents. He was never ever told. She left the property and married this Atwood Gardner and had about 16 children. And Ted left home when he was 11, and he was just hanging around the streets in Coonamble, and this fellow that owned a string of racehorses took a bit of a liking to him and took him to New Zealand with him as a stable boy. And I think Ted must have learned shearing over there, because he came back and sort of was a shearer all his life, and met my grandmother Josephine in Forbes. That's where they started off, but eventually moved to Katoomba. That's about it.
Right, interesting story. And what must have been a big thing in those days, a bit of a shame to marry a convict, was it? Was it still looked down on in those days?
Well, he according to the family history, he married Isaac had the only child he had was with this Aboriginal woman, and then he married two ex-convicts after that, but didn't have any children with them. And I think he the stigma was the half caste child William. When he married this English woman, Emma Elliott, I think there was a lot of stigma attached to that.
Who Dad thought were his brothers were really his uncles. and they gave him a bad time. And he ran away from home when he was 11. And like Bill said, he went off to New Zealand.
Yeah, and
became a shearer.
Now, tell me a little bit about your growing up here in Millers Point, Eileen. What sort of...
I didn't grow up in Millers Point. I grew up in Katoomba.
Okay.
My mother went to Katoomba, and I grew up there. I came here when I was 17, right. In 1930.
Can you describe life as it was in Millers Point at that time, in 1930? What?
It was much the same as it is now, only the... Who was at the Harbour Trust and the houses instead of the Housing Commission? Maritime Service Board, I think. That passed from the Harbour Trust to the Maritime Service Board. And then just before your father died, about a couple of years, the Housing Commission took over. And we were in this house then.
This very house here?
Yeah.
So you've lived in number 5 Windmill Street since you were 17?
No. I lived with my mother. I didn't meet my husband until I was 21, I met him.
Yeah.
And his people lived on Millers Point. And I came down here to live with him when I got married. His father got us a house from the Maritime Service Board next door to them. And we moved in there. And then we exchanged. It was only four-roomed house, and we had 6 children and ourselves, and we got their permission to move into this house in 1946.
So where was the very first house that you lived in Millers Point? Where was that situated?
Delgetty Road.
And what number?
19.
19 Delgetty Road. Yep. Can you describe the house as it was? Can you describe the layout of the rooms, how many stories it had, a little bit about the house?
Well, there was one room at the back that Bill and his brother, which should have been a kitchen, but Bill and his brother shared it as a bedroom. There was only 2 other bedrooms and a living room. And the laundry served as a kitchen. It had a gas stove and a fuel copper in it, and tubs with board on top. I used as a bench to...
It was single story.
Harry lived
had there. Had a tiny little backyard out the back and an outside lavatory. And as Harry Lappin and his family used to live upstairs from us.
Harry Lappin?
Mm.
Upstairs in the same house?
Same.
Well, it's like a terrace. They were separate places, but one was on top of the other.
They had to go up a stairway up the front. The stairway led to there. Front door, and we were down underneath them.
Okay.
Yeah, so all the houses were in that terrace were like that. You know, there was a downstairs separate house and 2 on top, separate houses with a stairway going between them, and 2 on top. And you know, they were 4 separate families lived in them.
All the way up the street, that was.
Yeah, that was the whole terrace like that.
And when you moved into this area, Millers Point, at 17 years of age, right?
I didn't move here until I was 22.
Into Millers Point?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. But you said 17. Where did the 17...
Well, I came to Sydney when I was 17.
Oh, I see. Right. But you lived somewhere else in Sydney?
Yeah, I lived out of Kensington.
Oh, okay. When you were 22, you were already married, were you?
I got married then.
Were you married when you actually moved into number 5 Windmill Street?
Yeah. I had children. I had all my children.
Delgetty Terrace, I mean.
Delgetty, yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. You were already married, were you?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they lived out at Kensington for a short while.
With my mother.
And then and Dad, he worked in the wool stores here, I think, and he wanted to live on Millers Point. And my grandmother wasn't very happy because it's a pretty rough area. And she said... to Mum, if you move down there, you'll never move out. And she was right. She's only 68 years.
I don't want to move out now. But she's thinking of the rocks as of the old days. I mean, it was practically the same. Well, it is the same. It was the same as it is now.
Oh, no, it's a lot different, Mum.
Well, I mean, it's the Housing Commission people, instead of families that were born here. Yeah. My brother went into the hotel and he said to my another son, your mother's been here since, you know, so many years, and yet she's only considered a blow-in. And he agreed with that. He said, but you're not. He said, his head shot around as though I'd shot him. He said, I was born here. So he said, I know the difference now from a being a blow-in and a... And, you know, somebody that's sort of really born here.
Well, you've lived here for about 70 years. You're still a blow-in?
Yeah.
You think so?
Yeah. but there's not many of the old people. When the Housing Commission took over and people had to pay rent for their children when they went, people thought they might as well be buying their own house and moved out. So there's very few of the old people.
But when I was a kid, it was after the war, I guess, you know, you'd, two or three times a week there'd be, you know, pitched battles in the street, wharf labourers or locals fighting seamen off the English ships that used to come in. And, you know, it was, you know, glasses and fists and kicking and God knows what. And, I mean, you just don't see that now.
Yeah. But, well, I didn't see it then.
Oh, no. You'd walk down the street and, you know, just got used to it. You just walk on the other side of the street while it's going on.
Bill, which year were you born, actually?
1939.
Right, okay. And you got married in 1930-something?
Five.
35, right.
Yeah. Okay. I had the daughter in 1935.
What was her name?
Murray. Murray Patricia. And then I had another son in 1937, Bill in 39. What year was Shanna born?
Shanna was 42. John's his name, but he couldn't get his tongue around John when he was a baby and he used to call himself Shanna, so that's just what he's known as now. Shanna.
Nobody would know him as John now.
he was 42, and David was 44. David died when he was 18. And
Owen
was 47, 46. Wasn't he?
46.
46, and Owen just died last year, and he was 58.
What was the problem with David? Why did he die?
He had some sort of brain disease. I think the doctors think it was a measles virus or something that lay dormant in his body for years.
Yeah, the doctor told me, he said, we don't know the cause of this or the cure anywhere in the world. He said, I give him 6 months to live. Well, he lived 2 years and 4 months. And I was pretty hysterical by the time he died. And I said, the doctor gave him 6 months to live. He said, well, he's young. There's nothing the matter with his heart. We've got no control over life and death. But he died a week later after I'd said that. So he was close to the end when I was at that stage. But then later on, they found that something lays dormant in the body from the measles. All the others had the measles. But in some people, something lays dormant and attacks them later. Like with polio, the same thing.
Did he die here at Millers Point?
He died
at in hospital at Glebe.
But only for a week.
Yeah, he'd only been in hospital a short time. And, no, we...
What was the reaction by the community when that event happened? It's such a tragic thing. I mean, did the community turn up and go to the funeral, that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah.
What
was the community reaction?
I think everybody was...
Everyone was, you know, sympathetic and that sort of thing. I mean, there was nothing anyone could do. I'd take him for drives, you know, in the car on the weekend. That was the only time we go out. My uncle, who used to live over in Dalgetty Terrace, he used to take him, you know, on long walks. He had a wheelchair and take him for a walk and that sort of thing. Yeah, it was a pretty sad time.
Sure, yeah. And Marie, is she also no longer alive?
Yeah, Marie died in 1970 with breast cancer.
Right, and she was about 30, 40, was she, about then?
She was 38 when she died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
And she left two children.
You've had a fair few tragedies in your life. How did that affect you?
And then my youngest son died 18 months ago.
Yes, he died.
With cancer.
He was 58.
Throat.
Right.
Well, I've lost three of my children. That amounts to. And it's pretty, as you say, I sat here one day and thought I had three brothers, three sisters, and six children, and nine of them have died. I've only got three living children.
Mum's the only one of her family left.
And all their partners have died. So if you live long, if you can live too long.
You've lived a long time. You were born in 1913, so are you actually 91 or are you turning 92 this year?
I'm 92 in August.
Are you? Well, you're fantastic. I would take my hat off.
Yeah, she's really good. She makes her own, makes all her own meals and makes me nice lunches when I come down. I try to come down once a fortnight. She's always got a nice lunch for me.
Uh-huh. Great. Mm-hmm. Now, going back to the very first house in Miller's Point again, Dalgetty Terrace, was it the single-story house that you had? You lived at the bottom, you said, and there was one
on
the top.
We lived on the ground floor.
How many bedrooms were there altogether?
Three. Well, we had three, but one should have been the kitchen, you know. One, we had a living room. Of course, when I got this place, got the opportunity to swap with a lady who only had one girl and her husband was mostly away at sea, thought it was wonderful, didn't we?
Yeah.
And I think we even had a couple of beds on the balcony.
Did you have a place to do the washing? Did you have a laundry or copper or something like that?
Yes. Yeah. What was the laundry, I'll explain to you, was a fuel copper. The tubs had a top on them that I worked off, a sink, and a gas stove.
And was that enough to do all the work you'd had to do?
Yeah. There was plenty of work to do. I remember I used to cook 22 lamb chops.
Why so many? Why so many?
Oh, well, we had people come and stay with us.
We always seem to have a guest. Mum's father, when he wasn't shearing, he'd come and stay with us. Mum's brother, the youngest brother, Owen, he actually went to school at St. Patrick's and lived with Mum. But
before I had all these children.
There wasn't six of us. Mum's mother, my grandmother, she was working at Warunga, I think, as a domestic, wasn't she?
A cook.
And she couldn't have him with her, so he lived with Mum. And then David, he stayed there. He
came back from the war.
He was the second youngest. He had malaria and he stayed with us.
I thought he had a cold, but I was washing his. He should have been in a military hospital, you know, because living in a house with all those children, it must have been dreadful for him.
And my father's sister, Peggy, Margaret was the name, called her Peggy. She used to, she's a bit of an alcoholic and she'd come and stay with us and cause a bit of disruption, she was always welcome. She was never ever turned in. But she was very wealthy. Had her own unit over at Kirribilli, but she preferred to come stay with us. You know, she have this unit. There.
You wouldn't think so. Right opposite the opera house, there was one house, four units there, and she lived in a unit. And they got such a small price for it, didn't they, in comparison to what they'd get these days?
Well, she died in the 50s, and her estate was £4,000, so it wasn't...
That was a really shocking price for a unit there.
I suppose the unit was probably worth $2,000 of it. She'd never married. She went to work for a stockbroker, and he sort of set her up as his mistress. She lived in Singapore for a long time, didn't she? His wife got sick, and she thought that
he'd marry her.
But he didn't. He married the wife's sister, and I think that was led to the drinking and a few other things.
Bill said she was an alcoholic, but she only went out 2 days a week. She'd be all the morning getting ready to go out, and she'd be home at tea time. But she knew she was walking into it. Nobody else in the family drank. My husband didn't drink. Her people didn't drink. She knew she was walking into a kind of a hostile atmosphere. So she'd come in singing, I'm as free as a breeze. I can do as I please. And I'd get under my husband's skin, wouldn't I? Yeah. But she was kind to me. You know, she was very kind to the family. I don't think she was in that. I wouldn't class her.
Probably wasn't, Mum. I mean, anyone that, but she couldn't go out without coming home drunk. She'd always be drunk.
She was a lovely girl. She took my grandpa.
You're right, and the fact that she didn't drink in the house or didn't hide bottles and all that, she probably wasn't an alcoholic, but she was.
She'd go out and meet. She went out with Mr. Smith and come home under the weather.
Eileen, as a young mother looking after a big family and so on,
yeah.
What sort of food were you cooking for them in those days? What kind of things did you eat at home?
Well, meat was a different price to what it is now. I used to get a sirloin roast of beef about that high for 15 shillings. And, as I said, 22 lamb chops. And remember old Jacko, the greengrocer? Pumpkin was 4.5 a pound. You know, 14 pounds of potatoes for a shilling. So, you know, food was laid on.
Yeah. Dad was a good provider. He always gave Mum 2/3 of his income to keep house. And then, so we always had good food. And we always had good clothes, but Mum would buy her clothes with a cash order. And so you got £30. It was usury, really. They charge you. You borrowed £30. You pay back £45 in 6 months, 20 weeks. I mean, it just wouldn't be allowed now. But that and I mean, that's how everyone bought there. By the time the £45 was paid back.
Kids all wanted new shoes again.
All wanted new shoes, and you just never got off the treadmill. That's what it was like. And it was 50% per annum.
My daughter got sick of hearing me say, when I get the cash orders paid up, she said, oh, Mum, you'll never get them paid up. But I did, and I went to work. My husband never expected me to go to work, but I was on the bus with a girl and I said, just sort of murmured, I wish I had a job. And she said, oh, well, I wish I knew somebody that'd do my job when school holidays were on, because she had to leave her daughter up at Liverpool. So I was a tea lady up at Celtics for about 2 weeks, and I'm counting up all the school holidays and everything and thinking how great it was. And I was only home a week and they asked me if I'd like to do the managing director's home one day a week, which suited. You had to go twice a day to be a tea lady. And I worked there for them, for the Japanese. He was the managing director of the Mitsubishi Company. And it was a terrific job, you know.
Which years was that then, Arlene?
In the 70s, I think.
It was before Mari died, so it would have been in the 60s because when Mari died, Mum gave the job up so she could mind or look after Mari's kids. So it would have been in the late 60s.
And Bill said to me, how much have you got in the bank, Mum? I said, nothing. And he said, you never will have while you put what I was earning in my purse. It just disappears out of your purse. So he said, put it in the bank. And from there, I never looked back from there.
Funny story, Frank. When Mum was working for those Japanese, she used to get off the bus in Park Street. They lived out in There were some suburbs to the Japanese. She got off the bus in Park Street, and she's walking down Pitt Street one day, and Pitt Street's a fairly busy street, but whatever had happened, there was no one around, only these two guys beating up this young bloke in the street. He had one of those calico bags full of money.
And oh, yeah, I forgot about
that. She's walking down the street, and these two guys have got this bloke on, and he's saying, "Grab the bag, grab the bag." My mum picked the bag up, walked off with it.
No, I walked into a shop.
And then I saw the name on the bag, House and House. It was a clothes shop in Pitt Street. She walked into the shop and gave him, didn't look in the bag or didn't know how much money was in there. Just gave him the bag back, and I didn't even say thank you. No reward or nothing.
Because I built him up, and I went into a shop and I held up the bag and showed him that I had it. And he said, "Take it down to House and House." So I did. But they never even said thanks.
Not very nice. Coming back to your husband, did he work all his life in the wool store?
No, he was a stove moulder when I married him.
A stove?
Stove moulder, a fuel stove, you know, cast iron.
It was a trade when he was a young guy. I'd make a moulding of sand.
And then pour them up.
They would pour metal into it, make fuel stoves and things like that. That was his trade. And he got out of work during the Depression.
They closed this moulding shop down.
And he eventually got a job in the wool stores, and he stayed there till he was 68. They didn't want him to leave.
Well,
it was very, very hard work. And at 68, he was doing as good a job as any of the young, strong guys here. They didn't want him to leave, but he left, and Mum and him went down to Barrel for 6 months, and they kept paying the rent here. Went down a barrel, and they were caretaking a property for a woman down there for 6 months. And I wish I would have stayed, but he didn't get on with a woman, and they came back. He'd never looked better. The fresh air and a bit of exercise and everything. He looked great.
The boys said to him, he used to sit in the chair in the corner there, "Dad, if you just sit there, you won't last 6 months." So I saw this ad in the paper, caretaker. And so I went and interviewed her, and I said, "You know, just tell us what you'd like us to do, because we wouldn't like to go up there and not do what you expected of us." And she said, "Oh, well, I've got a very good dog here, a working dog, and I want... It's no good here. I want it up on the property. I just want you to put it in at night, because if it joins up, others, it'll be a pack of dogs and get into trouble." And, you know, we got no pay, but we had a separate cottage. And Jane and Craig had come up in their school holidays. They loved it. And the lady said to Jane, "Your grandmother took to it like a duck to water." But she said, "I couldn't understand you, because they were at cross purposes all the time. She'd never give him any credit for anything he did. A tree'd fall over the fence, he'd saw it off. She wouldn't sort of acknowledge it, you know."
She had a couple of hundred sheep, I think, on the property, and they raised one of the lambs was orphaned, and they raised it. It was just like a pet.
As soon as I'd opened the door, he thought I was its mother. I cut the finger off a rubber glove and put it on a bottle and start feeding it. And Samson opened the door and bar and run to my
Dad never wouldn't eat lamb again, would he, after that?
Didn't he?
No, he didn't eat.
This is the end of tape number MPFH1 side A. This is the start of tape number MPFH1 side B. Now, Eileen, you were here during the Depression at Miller's Point, right, in the 30s. What was it like around here in the Depression for you?
Well, thinking back, I hardly knew there was a Depression, because the butcher said, you know, there were coupons. He said, "You give me your coupons and you get what meat you want." So I wasn't really on that. And the clothing, I didn't have enough money to use all those coupons up. And the fruitman, we're the last person on his run, and the fruit boxes were made of wood. He used to throw about three or four boxes of into my yard, and there'd be half a dozen apples or something in them that he didn't want to bother taking home. And it was he was a character, really, because this lady said she wanted a pound of pumpkin, and he just cut off about 2 pounds and handed it to her. And she said, I only wanted a pound. So when he couldn't stand it any longer, he grabbed it off but cut it in half. And that was a big joke to him. He said, you only wanted a pound, so you've got a pound. No change. But wasn't he a character?
Were there for some reason, all of the tradesmen used to look after Mum. There was the butcher. Well, apart from giving her good meat and that sort of thing, whenever she's having a baby, he'd drive you up to the hospital, wouldn't he? And pick you up when you came out of hospital. And the greengrocer, Mr. Jackson, Walter Jackson as he's known, he'd sort of come round and do his deliveries, and he'd just say to Mum, I'll send one of the kids up Saturday afternoon, and whatever grocery, whatever fruit and vegetables he had left over, I'd just go up with a bag and he'd fill it up for her.
I said to his son later, he died, and I said to his son, oh, your father was very good to me. He said he was good to a lot of people, Mrs. Pearson, but you're the only one that's ever said anything about. He was generous to a fault, to everybody, really.
Sure. Apart from the shops that were selling things like the butcher and so on, were there any hawkers on the street selling stuff and with their carts and so on?
There was a rabbito come around.
But there used to be a Chinaman come around, Charlie, but we call him Charlie, and they never call the Chinaman Charlie. Big fat Chinaman. He used to have a big sort of port, like a large suitcase, and he'd knock on all the doors, and I think the Bennetts used to buy clothes. He used to sell women's clothes and that. Remember him, Charlie?
No, I don't remember him, Bill. Perhaps I never dealt with him.
Oh, yeah, he came around for years and years. I know you didn't buy anything off him, but the Bennetts used to, and different people in the terrace. And this was later. This was in the 50s. There used to be a guy come around the pubs selling raffling chickens. And he'd say, oh, do you want to buy a ticket? No, he said, I'll hold this for me. And he'd probably have 20 or 30 people that have bought tickets, and he'd have all the rest. And you claim that if one of the ones he'd given you that you hadn't paid for, you won the chicken. You just take the chicken, he'd give you 2 shillings, you give the chicken back to him.
Well, there was a shoplifter, Millie, in the street. And I said to Mari when she started work, soon as Millie knows you're at work, she'll be down asking you things. And I said, don't buy anything off her, So, sure enough, she knocks on the door. Poor Mary, I think she would have loved to be in it. Gloves. She's suggesting all the things she can have. Twin sets, gloves, this, and she's, no thanks, Millie. No thanks, Millie. And I thought, oh, I bet she wishes Mum wasn't listening. But I said, if you walk up the street, if you've got a nice cardigan on, oh, she got that off Millie, So I didn't want to be walking around in things
Now, what year was it that you actually moved to Windmill Street from Dalgetty Terrace?
Well, it was a bigger house.
Which year was it?
What year? We moved in here in 1947, I think. Mum had died in 46.
No. That was after I'd started work. It was probably in the 60s, I think, Mum.
No, it wasn't.
Well, Mum, I was up at Barrel from 1952 to 1956, and you were still living in the terrace then. And then I started my first job at AEI was still living in the terrace then. So I'm pretty sure it was late, would have been 59, 60, 61, something like that.
Okay, we'll check it later on. Yes. Eileen, going back to the terrace before you moved, what were the neighbours like? Did you have good relations with them?
Yes.
Who were the immediate neighbours, the names and what did they do for a living?
Well, my mother-in-law lived next door. Who lived next door to them?
There was the Lappins on top.
They were all long-time residents. They weren't housing commission resident people. They were maritime service. And they lived there. Most of the people lived on Miller's Point had lived there all their lives.
So the Lappins above, who was on your mother-in-law next to you?
Yeah.
Who was on the other side?
Her brother. My mother-in-law's brother.
No, on
the side, on the other side.
On the side going up.
Oh, God.
21 was Jack Lloyd.
Yeah.
Remember Jack?
Yeah.
Jack, I don't think he was married. He was the tenant and he just had a couple of guys that used to live there, you know, paying for a room. And then there was the Pearsons, or grandparents. They were in 17. 15 was the Stewarts. That was...
Her brother.
My grandmother's brother. And then there were flats. There were probably four flats. As I say, Marcel Stewart was her name. She moved in there in one of the flats.
Yes, it was mostly locals that moved into the place, you know. Still there's not that many locals around, but Cuth Birds. When a girl got married, you hardly knew a married name. You know, she was always remained. Cuth Reardon went to school with my daughter. She became Cuth Burgess. She lives up in Argyle Place. And there's a lot of that, you know, about. But then, as I said, a lot of people, when the Housing Commission took over and they had to pay for their children when they went to work, thought they might as well be paying off their own house and moved out.
To a different area.
Yeah.
Right.
So, but you couldn't buy these houses.
No, sure. Now, you had your immediate family so close by. What was it like living so close with your family? Any problems?
Well, I think now I didn't appreciate my in-laws. When I see my granddaughter with nobody, if I could leave the children knowing that they're... grandmother and aunties and that were next door. And I've only had to see my granddaughter shopping. Life was different. McElrath's come and took your grocery order, delivered it. And to say the milkman, the baker and that'll... None of that service is there now. You've got to go out. You even wait at the counters to get served. You wait at the checkout to pay out. Life's different altogether nowadays.
So people used to deliver everything you order to your house?
Yes. Well, the grocery order, come and take your grocery order and deliver it. And no charge for that. And then the butcher, he was here on the point, I've seen a write-up about him. He was there 2 years before my husband was born in 1908. He was there in 1906.
Was that Duggan?
Yeah.
Yes.
Joe Duggan.
Was he a good butcher?
He's wonderful.
Yeah, he's a good man.
He said, I met him in the street one day. He said, I'm glad I got out when I did. He said, I'd never get the prices that they'd get today. Couldn't know. So I see a leg of lamb for about $35. I'd get a big sirloin roast of beef for 15 shillings.
Now, how did people sustain themselves during the Depression? Did they fish onto the wharves, that sort of stuff, do you know?
Oh, I don't think they had to. We were always all fished down the wharf, yeah, but it was only a matter of if they caught fish or not. We didn't depend on that.
Yeah. Yeah, especially in summertime, the wars down there. All the old people would have their step. They sat there, no one else was allowed to sit there. There was an old lady, Mrs. Burns, lived in High Street, and she'd fish every night, get down there and catch her bait, the little yellowtail for bait to catch tailor. And she'd be there probably 5 o'clock every night and fish till about 10, go home, never miss.
And provide enough food for the dinner table next day?
Oh, she'd get some decent fish. Tailor and jewfish were the main ones they used to catch, and they were quite good eating.
What about Hickam Morton? He used to catch leather tail about that big, and my father-in-law would get about 8 of him for a few shillings.
Yeah.
He'd come in and give me 4.
This fellow's name was Jimmy Morton, and he had a speech impediment, so he had the nickname Igger. That's what they called him. And,
everybody had a nickname.
he was a bit, I suppose you'd say, retarded, which with his speech impediment made it worse, but I don't think he ever had a job, but he used to go out spearing leather jackets.
Spear them.
Spear with a big sort of, you just see they're a sort of flat, slow-moving fish, and you just get the spear. And he'd catch a sugar bag full and sort of sell them. That's the only way he's living, but he
My father-in-law used to buy more than he wanted and give us some.
Were there any other such neighbourhood characters around, rather eccentric people and that sort of stuff?
Oh, yes. What about Boy Doohan? What was his name?
Jimmy Doohan.
Poor boy.
Jimmy was part Mongoloid, was slightly Mongoloid, and he used to make his living getting wood. Had a big barrow, and he'd just go down the wharf and get driftwood
sell wood.
Wood that was left lying around, that just fill up the barrow and sell wood by the barrow load.
But they used to take the wheels off his barrow, torment him, something shocking. And David was sitting out on the front veranda, and he's used to this, and he's delivering wood to someone. He said, "Jimmy." And I said, "Don't, David, don't. He might throw some wood over it." And over came a log that just nearly just missed us. So I spoke to his sister. I said, "Tell him David's sick and that." Well, from there on, he used to come and put his hand in and shake hands with David,
Now, did the Millers Point people feel a bit different from the other Sydney siders? Did you have a kind of identity, a village sort of identity here?
No, I don't think so.
What was that, Ben?
Did you feel did you identify as Millers Point, different to...
Oh, well, the girls put on a bit of side. They used to say they come from Point Miller. They didn't like to say they come from Millers Point, they'd say. If they met some stranger sort of thing, Point Miller.
A bit like Point Piper?
Yeah, Point Piper.
So but did it feel like a village? Was there sort of a village atmosphere there? Eileen.
Bloody a cow, Bill.
Huh? So Bill's just getting organised. Eileen, did you feel different? Did you feel like you were living in a small village? Was it that sort of atmosphere? Or was it like being in the city?
Oh, I don't know how I felt. When they first told me where it was, I was working with some girls and they told me, the rocks, the cap. So coming from the country, I imagined there was big rocks and the cut in the rocks. So I've walked right around under the harbour bridge expecting to get stabbed in the back or something. But I'm just having relatives here, and that I just blended in. And, I just want to stay here as long as I can. Although I realise I'll have to go somewhere pretty shortly.
Yes, I've been doing some family history for my boys, the two branches of my wife's family and two branches of ours. And the ones that go back the furthest in the rocks is my father's mother's family. Her name was Isabel Agnes Stewart. Her father was Ninian Stewart, and he is born on the rocks. He was a bootmaker. He owned a shop in George Street North, and one of the local tough guys was a boxer called Young Griffo. Albert Griffiths is Australia's first world champion boxer, and he was a brilliant fighter but a drunk, and apparently the only way they could keep him sober was get him on the day of the fight and lock him in the bootmaker's shop in one of the back rooms, and they just keep him there till the fight. And he won the world championship in New Zealand, fought a New Zealander called Murphy, and had gone to America and won the world championship and came back. And apparently Griffo went over there and fought him, won the world title, but Americans didn't recognise the world title if it was fought outside of America. And on the boat trip back, they ran into really rough weather, and he swore he'd never go on a boat again. And they realised the only way to get him the world title was to go to fight in America, so they got him that drunk. They put him on the boat, and he woke up at sea. And I've just been reading about him in the American Boxing Hall of Fame. He wouldn't come back. He died in America in 1927.
Was he a Millers Point or a Rocks character?
Yeah, he lived on the rocks. I think he was born in Newcastle. He came in here as a young bloke, but these things I was reading on the internet, he was a paper boy around here, he used to sell papers. And the guy that owned the paper shop sacked him. He was too noisy, and when he was a fighter, he'd go back to the paper shop drunk. Come on, sack me now. Get out here and sack me.
But another thing of interest, like that house up in Argyle Street, opposite the bus that's just been sold for over $1.5 million, I think, it was not sold, but leased out for so long, 90 years. All the Pearsons were born in there, all Mrs. Pearsons, her two brothers and her. She had all Bill's father and all her children in that house. But two of her brothers had the attics for boot shops, and they were going to charge them more rent because it was a business, so that's when they moved down to Dalgetty Road.
What was the main occupation of the men of Millers Point?
Wharf labour.
Most of them were in the wharf labour?
And coal lumper.
Yeah, my grandfather was a coal lumper. An extinct job now, but what they used to do, the colliers used to come down from Newcastle with coal, and they'd shovel it onto the wharf and then shovel it onto the steamships. That was their fuel, for the steamships.
Yeah.
But a lot of them were wharfies, and then a few storemen. My father, he didn't want to go on the wharves because they were always on strike, and there was just...
And they picked out the wharfies.
It was better money than storemen, but it wasn't regular. It was... He preferred, take less money and work a steady job.
Right. What about your father, Eileen? What was he doing for a living?
Sure. Sure.
Up in Queensland or somewhere?
Oh, wherever they were shearing sheep, mostly in New South Wales, I think.
Yeah, he came from Coonamble, but he I think, did most of his shearing in the Western Districts, and that's where he met my grandmother at Forbes. She was...
Never been Forbes.
She was the youngest of 13 children, and they lived in Forbes.
One grandmother had 16 children, and the other one had 13. When I was reading about them later, I was getting all mixed up because after they'd had all those children, they'd become bush nurses. Mum's mother was a bush nurse for 50 years and never lost a patient. And they just went out into the bush, nursed the women with what was there when they got there.
Formidable women, aren't they?
Yeah.
Now, can I take you to the war years now in Millers Point?
Yes.
What were they like for you?
Well, I had... who did I have? Shanna, I think, when I was in Crown Street. Had Shanna, the mother said it.
42.
Yeah.
Well, David would have been born before the end of the war, too. He was born in 44.
We had a threat of... We all had to leave our houses and go down the lower road into our shelter because it was a false alarm, really, but it was frightening.
Yeah, I remember going down there, you know, the air raid siren would go and everyone would have to leave their houses and go down to the shelter.
And they were all singing "Roll Out the Barrel" and all these songs going.
The shelter was all had all sandbags packed up against the walls. Yeah. And,
but we're going down. I had a baby in arms, a couple of other young ones and three others, and... Just thinking if a bomb was to fall, the kids would scatter. It's terrifying going down. But when you got down there, they were all singing these songs and it was different. And it was a false alarm, I think.
You used to have all the windows with this brown paper covering so the lights wouldn't show.
Yeah. Oh, we'd lived through it.
Were people quite worried about a Japanese invasion in those days?
I don't think so. Oh, I don't think I was.
Well, I was only four.
Yeah,
three or four.
You wouldn't have thought about it.
Right. Okay.
We didn't have much of a threat from the Japanese coming, did we?
No, there was a submarine in Sydney Harbour. That's as close as they got, of course.
Well, we had to read about that in the paper.
So you had ration cards again during the war, did you?
Oh, yes, we had ration cards during the war.
Did you use them all up?
No. As I said, the butcher said, you give me your ration card and I'll give you all the meat you want.
Right. Oh, you told me earlier, but that was during the Depression, I thought.
No, that was during the war.
During the war.
We didn't have ration cards before then.
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought. Did you knit scarves for soldiers overseas, that sort of thing? People did that at times?
No, I knitted jumpers and that for my own children.
Had enough knitting. What entertainment was there in Millers Point for families to do?
Well,
how did you entertain yourselves, the families?
I don't think I entertained myself at all. I was busy cooking, washing, ironing.
Well, we used to go to the pictures on a Saturday afternoon. It was more or less our entertainment. And at home, we had the radio, you know, and we'd listen to the fights or the cricket.
But making barrows out in the backyard.
Sunday night, you weren't... I used to have a... radio show called the Lux Radio Theatre. No one was allowed to talk while that was on.
No, you didn't breathe while that was on, in case best of word. The kids were different to what they are today.
What was your favourite radio show, Eileen?
Oh, I don't know that I had one. I can't think of, I can't remember. Probably that Sunday night one. But we didn't sit and listen to the radio. Like we might after tea or that. But everybody was in bed. You know, not long ago I went up to one of my sons and I said, oh, I was lucky when you kids were born. I said, they were all born healthy. The hotels closed at 6 o'clock. We never heard of drugs. They could all get a job when they left school. And nobody come home with tattoos on themselves or anything like that. Next morning, son that was visiting his brother rang me up and he said, I worked from the time I was 15 till I was 65, and you just think it was a matter of luck. His brother had to explain to him that that was only an expression. He said, "Does it ever cross your mind that all your grandchildren are working and they're all doing well?"
That's good.
Did you ever go to the Tivoli or vaudeville shows? Was that something you did in the 30s and 40s?
No. When Bill's sister'd stay with us and she went to the... If she'd go to the movies, she'd tell us if something was good. She'd mind the children while we went. It was only a very odd occasion we went to the movies. We didn't have a lot of it. We didn't expect it.
Right, sure, your expectations weren't what they are now.
No, Dad was a good provider, but he wasn't, lavish in taking Mum out and things like that.
What about people like Roy Rean? Did you ever, or Mo, you know, people like that? Did you ever see them perform?
Well, I didn't see him. I saw a few shows, but not when the children were young. Probably when we come over here. Saw a few shows.
In the 60s. What about dancing? Did you ever do any dancing at the Trocadero?
No.
Wasn't your thing, was it?
No, and not my husband's thing either.
Did the men have much social life in the pubs and so on?
Well, my husband didn't drink at all till we came here into this house. And then the fella living next door, he was really, really nice. He coached the boys in football, didn't he? And he brought your father out a bit. Every day, when Bill'd come home from church, he'd have a couple of bottles of beer, so Bill'd it, and he'd have a drink with George till his wife would call out the dinner was ready, and, "Oh, there's the voice of Bill, Doom or something, Bill," and then he'd go. But they'd talk about the sport, and that it was good for your father, wasn't it? Bill liked to
bet. He didn't go to the pub like most of the men around here. He'd go up. Mum's brothers would come down at Christmas time and take him up the pub, and he'd have a few beers then. But
nearly fall down when they'd see him walking.
He'd go the rest of the year, wouldn't have a drink, until he moved around here, and then he
never heard him use a swear word.
He sounds like a perfect man.
He's pretty good. He probably had his faults like everyone else.
Yeah. He had all his faults I blamed onto his family. Because the way you read, you know, I don't think he thought it was the right thing to enjoy yourself.
He was a bit of a gambler before he got married, and during the Depression he had to sell his bank book. He had a few hundred pound in that. And had to sell it for about a tenth of its value because the banks were
the
closed.
Jews bought up the.
And he never had a bank account after that. But he always had money, or always had a couple of hundred pound or a few hundred dollars in his wardrobe. And, mum would buy something on hire purchase, and one time he was going to have to pay it out or something, and he said, "The pessimists always have to pay for the optimists." So instead of just keeping quiet, she said, "Well, they'd want to be a pessimist."
Okay, I'm just going to have to make an announcement. That's the end of tape number MPFH1 side B.